Welcome to Everybody Slay, Everybody Gay,
a queer exploration of the Scream franchise.
With your hosts, Speak Pirate, aka Joanna. I'm here, I'm queer, and I consider Nev Campbell my root.
Well, see, I was going to say, and LCO123, aka Vina, a proud member of the Church of Nev Campbell. So, you know, it works. It works either way.
Yes.
Spoiler alert, there's going to be lots of Nev Campbell talk in this episode.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Oh, so let's start with just talking a little bit about our relationship to the Scream franchise. As you know, I am not like a horror movie person at all.
Yeah.
But I have made an exception for the Scream movies due to my enduring love for Nev Campbell.
You know, valid reason. Yeah, I mean, I feel like Scream is like the horror franchise that like film nerds love, because it's just so full of in jokes, and it's clever and it's funny, and it's, you know, it's a whodunit. It actually has a lot of similarities to PLL. I don't actually remember when I saw the first Scream movie, but I will tell this brief story, which I maybe have told you before, which is that I was on vacation with my family right around the time that Scream TV show was coming out. It was kind of popular for a few years. And so in preparation for that show, they were airing all of the Scream movies like back to back to back on MTV. And I, for some reason, I was like, I think maybe it was, I don't know if it was like Stormy or there was some reason why we needed to stay inside. And I was like, okay, we are going to watch all of these. And so my dad was the only one who he graciously watched all of them with me. I think everybody else kind of like tuned in and tuned out, but we watched all of the Scream movies out of order for some reason. And I just was like, I just love this franchise. It was the first time I'd sat down and watched all of them. This was the original four. This was before the fifth one came out, obviously. And they are, you know, absolutely the quality diminishes as you go on. But it's just such a fun franchise. Like it's a lot of just, it's like a lot of fun Scooby-Doo stuff. It's a lot of fun dialogue. I love a media thing that like references other media things. I love the use of like the references to, you know, Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and all of that. Like it's smart and it's entertaining and it's lively and it's a good time. They are good time movies.
Yeah, I totally agree. I definitely saw, I have a very vivid memory of seeing the first Scream movie in the theaters. And one of the things that I'll tell you about that is that, of course, now, you know, spoilers for all the Scream movies if you're listening to this podcast. Oh, yeah. But like, one of the things we didn't know at that time was that Drew Barrymore was going to be killed in the first couple minutes of that movie. Like,
right.
Like everybody thought Drew Barrymore was like one of the stars. Like that we were gonna,
yeah.
Like, because she was like a much bigger name than a lot of other people who were in the movie at that point. So I just remember it being like totally shocking.
Yes.
when her character dies within like just the opening scene.
Yeah. And I really think that like that whole sequence is one of the most like effective little pieces of filmmaking ever. Like it is just, it's almost a short film in and of itself.
That yeah.
Scene.
Well, I would actually say that the opening scenes of all of the Scream movies, by and large, have really been like innovative and interesting. Cause like once that happened, it was always like, it's expected now. It's expected that the movie is going to open with this. And so every time you're like setting this expectation and it's like, can they do it? Can they do it again? How is it going to play out? How is it going to work? And one of the things that they're really good at, like, so it's Drew Barrymore in the first one. I think it's Jada Pinkett Smith in the second one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like in this most recent one, you always wind up caring about that character, even yes. though they've been on screen for like a maximum of 5 minutes, probably four of which they spent about to be murdered. So it's really like, it's really kind of a tribute, I think, to the way that the movies are written, that they pull that off every time.
Well, unless we forget, in Scream 4, our one and only Lucy Hale makes an appearance, as well as Kristen Bell, who we talked about in our Veronica Mars recap. So, yeah, I mean, Scream 4 does a whole, like, they really lean hard into the meta. Scream 5 really feels like it's kind of going back to the basics. But then an interesting thing in Scream 5 is, like, that girl lives. Like, yes. That's the reversal of expectations.
Yes, that's what I mean. I feel like they are really good at kind of, like, keeping it fresh in ways that you don't always expect.
I agree. And something about Scream, like, I read, and I'll, if I can find it, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But I read an interview with Kevin Williamson, who wrote, I don't know that he wrote all of them. He at least wrote the first Scream movie. And he is a gay man. And he talks about, like, the sort of the queerness of Scream and the queerness of Sidney Prescott and how I love that, because I have yet to meet a queer person who doesn't love the Scream movies, I think. Like, there is this real, like, queer love around these movies. And maybe we could talk a bit about that. Like, what do you think that is about? Like, what is it about these stories that appeal to a queer audience?
Well, I think that I've read that interview too, where he talks about, like, the Scream movies that he wrote being very queer coded, and that Sidney Prescott as the final girl, he was, like, sort of recreating, like, growing up as a gay teen, like, in the 90s and in the early aughts, like, and how you have to, like, go through all this trauma and figure out a way to survive. And I feel like there is something like deep within all of us that when we see the Scream movies, on some level, we recognize that that's part of where the writing was coming from. So I think that is a big part of it. I also think that the Scream movies, like, they do camp in a really interesting way. Like, they are campy sometimes, but it's like an elevated version of camp that I feel like queer people respond to really well. And then I also feel like the character of Gale Weathers over time, like over the run of the Scream movies, has really kind of, like, leaned into the bitchy drag queenness of of that character. Yeah.
I think that's a great point. I also think that there's something sort of inherently queer about Ghostface as a symbol, because I think, unlike, you know, your Freddies or your Jasons or your Michael Myers, like, Ghostface is somebody different in every movie, sometimes multiple people, and always somebody very human. Like, even if it's dumb, we do get, like, the backstory, and whoever is putting on the Ghostface mask is usually somebody who is very broken and is trying to feel powerful and is trying to be, have people pay attention to them. You know, somebody who feels, like, ignored or neglected by society in some ways. And one of the things that I love about Ghostface is, like, Ghostface is very human. Ghostface is clumsy. Ghostface, you know, like,
love it when Ghostface is clumsy.
Yeah. Oh, Ghostface gets kicked and punched and falls down and gets injured. And, you know, isn't always, like, super successful and high tech and, you know, all knowing in their kills. And yet, in other ways, they are, you know, like, sometimes they have these superpowers sort of, and sometimes they don't. That sounds a lot like Mona Vanderwaal, you know, like, there is something kind of, there is this sort of compelling sadness about Ghostface in this strange sort of way. And, you know, and then in, like, the first movie, I think it's the subtext is almost amped up to main text when Billy and Stu are revealed as the killers, and they have a very queer Leopold and Loeb kind of energy about them.
Yeah, that's actually in that same Kevin Williamson interview where he talks about Billy and Stu being based on Leopold and Loeb. So, yeah, being, like, overtly, kind of overtly borrowing from queer killers.
Yeah, and I think that there's something so interesting in that about the idea of a queer writer sort of playing with the queer villain trope in this way. Like, because I think, like, an interesting thing about the queer villain trope is, like, by making somebody, like, by making somebody villainous because they are queer, there's it sort of is implying that there's a certain power in queerness, right? There's a power to be frightening and to be evil, but there's also there's just a power in general, right? Because like villains are inherently powerful. And so I don't know, there is something really interesting about the way that Scream kind of remixes some of those tropes, I think.
Yeah, and I'm also really interested in the idea of Billy Loomis as a queer villain, considering that, like, he's Sydney's boyfriend in the first film. That's how he's introduced. And now in the fifth film, we know that he was also, like, sleeping with some other girl in the high school who then, like, is the mother of Sam Carpenter. So I think that that is really, like, an interesting idea of, like, Billy being a character who is, like, kind of trying to prove his masculinity in a way. And also that you get, like, these visions of Billy that Sam is having in this film. And it's not, like, you can't call it, like, a redemption arc for Billy by any means, but, like, you get the sense that, like, Sam is a person who has to, like, come to grips with the fact that, like, this darkness or this illness is inside of me. Yes. And I have to, like, make peace with it in order to continue to exist in this world.
Well, also interesting is that Billy quotes Norman Bates, who's a very queer-coded character.
Yes.
The Psycho films. Yeah, I actually loved the use of Billy in this new Scream movie. I haven't read, like, a ton of, you know, discourse about Scream 5, honestly. And I feel like there are probably people out there who really hated the use of Billy. I loved it. I thought it was creepy and weird and kind of funny. But I also, like, I really liked that it wasn't a black and white thing. And that what, like, sort of saves this character of Sam, who has spent her whole life kind of being afraid of what's inside her, is leaning into that part of herself.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the sequels in general and this sequel in particular?
Well, I think that in general, until this movie, the quality of the sequels has kind of, like, gone down as the numbers went up. Like, the original, of course, except No Substitutions, really the best. Did really enjoy Scream 2. And I feel like there are a lot of things that I like about Scream 3, but you do have to admit that, like, tonally, it's not as cohesive. Like, there are definitely, like, parts where the wear is starting to show along the seams of the concept. In general, I would have said, like, you know, the order that I like them in is probably, like, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, depending on the day, I might flip 4 and 3, but mostly it's 3, 4. But this one, this fifth installment, I actually liked it a lot. Like, I would put this, like, probably second or third in my ranking of the sequels.
I agree. I think something that the fourth film really struggled with, that the fifth film, I thought, really did kind of perfectly, was, like, I think the fourth film struggled with, like, whose story is this? Is this the story of two kids, or is this the story of our original characters? And it's interesting because this movie really feels like it's sort of in conversation, not just with the other Scream movies, but with the whole concept of sequels. And there's this whole Jasmine Savoy Brown is the delightfully sort of film nerd, you know, the Randy Meeks of 2022 kind of character. Who gives this whole speech about the idea of requels and how a requel, it's not quite a reboot, it's not quite a sequel, it's sort of something in between. And I think that Scream 5 does that really, really well, where all of the, like, the three, you know, Dale and Dewey and Sydney, they all feel like they've grown, they feel like they're older, they feel like their lives have been going on. This does not necessarily feel like their story. It does feel like a passing of the torch, and yet they all are significant to the plot. And I just think that, like, that is a very hard thing to do. And I feel like they really pulled it off, like, that balance.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think your point about this is, like, the requel, the first three films have, like, specific characters, the original, the sequel. Yes. oh no, we're in a trilogy, as Randy yes. says in his video. So there are like specific roles that they play. And I think that might be why the fourth one is a bit more at sea, because it doesn't have a defined role within that universe. Like it's, there's not anything that it is really in conversation with or about. But now Scream 5 is showing up at this time where everything gets a reboot. Like PLL is getting a reboot and it's barely been off the air.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's coming in at a different time, and there are a lot of other elements that this movie is able to be like in conversation with in a meta way. And that's always, I feel like, when Scream is at its best, when it's yes. like, when it is like leaning into while also subverting the tropes of the genre.
Oh, I totally agree. And I also think a thing with that Scream 4 does is like they pretty much kill off all of or almost all of the new kids. And so it's making it very clear, this is not about them. You don't care about them. You only care about our three original characters. And Scream 5 actually keeps a lot of the young kids alive, which I think is super smart, because it's like, now, you know, they can be in the Scream 6 that I'm sure is already in development. Or even if they're not, even if we start over with a whole new crop of kids, there is this sense that, like, these were real characters who mattered, who had an impact on the story, and who got to survive. Because, you know, in a horror movie, survival is always kind of the reward you get, right? And I actually really liked a lot of these new characters.
Yeah, I totally agree. When you were saying that, I've only seen Scream 4 one time. I have not rewatched it since the first time that I saw it. But I was like trying to even just in my mind picture any of the new kids, except for the one very memorable one who winds up like the twist at the end being responsible for everything. I was trying to remember like any of the new kids or any of the murders of those kids, and I was coming up blank. So like maybe Scream 4's real sin is that it's just like it doesn't have like memorable characters or memorable storytelling.
I agree. To me, the most compelling part of Scream 4 is the twist that,
yes.
Spoilers, that Emma Roberts is the murderer. And I do really like the scene where she like is like making herself look like a victim and lays down yes. next to Sydney. I think that was really effective. And I actually had the question watching this. I was like, you know, the one thing that Scream 4 did really well is the reveal of who Ghostface was. How are they going to handle that in this movie? What did you think of the Ghostface reveal?
Ooh, well, it's so interesting. Ghostface is so interesting because, like, how do I want to say it? Like, we talked about Ghostface being human. We talked about Ghostface being clumsy. But, like, one of the things about Ghostface is that the person who is Ghostface yeah. almost never matters as much as the motive for
sure.
Ghostface. And I think that that's really interesting. One of the things that this movie did with the Ghostface reveal, it felt like it took a lot longer to get to it, like to get to the
yeah.
final act where Ghostface is revealed. And also, they really like hold out, because like, of course, there are two killers, as there often are in the Scream franchise. And so even when you have one, you don't know who the other one is going to be. So like, even Sidney Prescott is yelling to, oh my gosh, what's his name? Is it Rodney? Is it the dude? The boyfriend.
Jack Quaid is, that's just what I think of him as, because that's his name in real life.
Right. So like, he's like running down the stairs and she's like yelling for him to like grab the gun because she thinks that he's still one of the good guys. And like, oh, nope. Once he gets to the bottom of the stairs, it's going to turn out that he is also one of the ghost faces. So I feel like that's really interesting. And I also think a really interesting element of the Scream movies is that by and large, when you get to the final act, you are not battling Ghostface. The killers are not in the costumes anymore.
Yeah.
When it comes to the big climax, you're always battling Ghostface in the human face of whoever it was. So I liked the kind of final climax of this one. I like that, of course, like Sydney and Gail are like the seasoned fighters, but you also have Sam and you have her sister and you have like some of their friends who wind up surviving. I really liked it. I liked the kind of rugged band of survivors that come through at the end and who are able to prevail. Like, and I like that you wouldn't, like, neither of those groups would have made it out alive without the other ones. Like, if Gail and Sydney hadn't dealt with one of the killers, Sam and her sister wouldn't have been able, you know, like,
yeah,
neither could survive if the others had just, like, ran out the front door.
Oh, I agree. Like, one of the things I love that, like, I don't think any other Scream movie has really ever done is the part where Sam and her sister are like, oh, well, we'll just leave town. Like, we'll just leave town. And later you realize, oh, they would have been leaving town with one of the killers, you know, and that the killer had been setting them up the whole time. Like, I think that that was great. And then that, of course, that doesn't work out. I agree with you. I did feel like the reveal took a while. It took its time. I really liked how the movie, because it's like you have the reveal of, again, I, for some reason, I know all the actors' names, but I don't know any of the characters' names. So Mikey Day, who's the young female Ghostface in this iteration, you have her reveal earlier and like, you're like, well, that sort of makes sense. What's that?
Amber. Her name is Amber.
Amber. And you have the reveal of Amber and you're like, well, that sort of makes sense. She's been kind of, her name is not Mikey Day. That's somebody else. Never mind. You have the reveal of her and you're like, that sort of makes sense. She's been kind of around. And I love the reveal of the boyfriend because it's very, it's like it's played with our expectations multiple times. He has seemed like the most obvious suspect, and that's been called out by multiple characters in the movie. And there is this thing of like, well, we're conditioned to trust the straight white man and we're conditioned to fear the straight white man. And I love that it's like the movie has basically said so many times to you at that point, well, it would be so obvious if he was Ghostface. Of course he's not Ghostface. That would be so obvious. It would be just ridiculous for him to be Ghostface. That I had bought it. I was surprised by that reveal. By the time it came around to him, I was like, oh, wow. I did not expect that. And I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was so great. It's interesting because thinking about, like, I agree with your ranking of the Scream movies. I actually think that the Scream 4 after the first Scream has probably the second most satisfying Ghostface reveal. I don't think the Ghostface reveal in Scream 2 is terribly satisfying. I think the Ghostface reveal in Scream 3 is really stupid.
The worst part of Scream 3, yes.
Absolutely, agreed. Absolutely. But I think that this was really a good one. And it what you were saying, too, about it playing out with the person in the human mask, human face, reminds me a lot of A. Reminds me a lot of A, the A reveals playing out that way. And I wondered if we could talk a little bit about sort of everybody A, everybody ghost face.
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of similarities between PLL and the Scream universe. One of which you just mentioned, which is that like they try to leave town and it doesn't work. Which is like the basic principle of A, like you can't get away from A. Like if you turn off your phone, A is going to send like worms in your Chinese food. Like A is always going, like if you close the curtains, A is going to find some other way of spying on what you're doing. So I feel like A has a lot of like Ghostface in their DNA and has a lot of like this universe. Also, I think that like, Ghostface as A, like Ghostface is a person, a regular person who's put on this costume. They're not a person who has superpowers, but when they put on this costume, they seem omniscient. Like they seem like they just know everything and they're so incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it gives them this extra power, the way that the black hoodie does, the way that the red coat does. And then when they don't have that on, some of their power seems to be stripped.
Yeah, I mean, the costume is even fairly similar. Like, Ghostface has this, like, long dark robe that includes a hood and a mask. Whereas we have frequently seen, we've seen Mona running around with a mask of Allison's face and her dark hoodie. And, you know, like, the costume is even fairly similar, I think.
I agree. And there are moments, like, of PLL that I do feel... are similar to Scream in certain ways. I mean, certainly like some of the jump scares and some of the shots, but I think that like many properties that came after the first Scream borrowed elements from it, which is great because Scream borrowed elements from like so many other properties that came before it.
Yeah, I definitely think that that's true. Another thing that I think that they have in common or are in conversation with about, we often talk about like on PLL, your biological family is your destiny. Like
yes.
whoever your parents turn out to be, like that just means that your story is written in a particular way until the end of time. And I feel like in this particular Scream movie, we get a lot of that. Like there are so many people who are related to original characters. We have Randy's niece and nephew, who are like kind of the new horror movie stands who are able to like talk about what's going on. We have Billy Loomis's daughter, who is like, you know, kind of taking a key role in this movie and also like kind of inheriting some of Sidney Prescott's baggage with like her mother was maybe having an affair with Cotton Weary and who was, you know, like kind of implied to be like a bit of a loose woman on the town, and now she's kind of having to deal with like the repercussions of her parents' divorce after she kind of dropped this bombshell. So I feel like you have a lot of people who are related to the first story in ways that like kind of mirror that idea that like if this is who you are, your life is not your own, your story is not your own. You're going to be like reenacting these murders until there are no more ghost faces left.
Right. And it's like at a certain point it becomes sort of like self, like a cannibalization thing in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like a self-obliteration sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's Billy as this character who is so full of rage at, because I think a thing that we see with the killers is that there's usually like one killer who just wants to kill and just wants the notoriety, and like one killer who has like a personal vendetta is often how it goes. And Billy is this character who just has so much like rage at his own circumstance that like the only thing he can think to do is to just take down the whole world around him, tear everything apart.
Yeah. I think that tracks. And I think that that is a great point. I also think like PLL and Scream, like you were just talking about how the boyfriend is like the suspect in plain sight. And because everyone is saying, oh, it's going to be the boyfriend. Like you're like, oh, they're saying it so often that it's definitely not going to be him. His name is Richie. I looked it up.
Richie. Yes, you knew it was
not. Whatever, the man. The dude. Him. But I think like PLL does a really similar thing in that they lean on like the whiteness and the handsomeness of Keegan and of Prezra and of Ren. Yeah. And it's like, well, they're so... you know, we're casting them as charming, and therefore, like, nothing that they do is really going to, like, read to you as bad or wrong.
Yeah, it's sort of like the ultimate get-out-of-jail-free card is their maleness and their straightness and their whiteness, in a sense.
And the love that, like, the characters, the other characters bear them.
And that, like, I actually think that Scream 5 did a pretty good job of, like, selling the romance between those two characters.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of the way that, like, okay, so Billy is Sydney's boyfriend in the first movie, and Richie is Sam's boyfriend in this movie, and both of them turn out to be the killers. There's, like, that parallel there. And I was thinking about the ways in which you can watch Billy in the first movie, and you can see, like, what you were saying, like, the rage that Billy has, like, how he's always, like, you know, he's always, like, kind of gaslighting Sydney for doubting him when, like, well, dude, you are the killer.
Yeah.
Like, the ultimate gaslighting. Like, he pretends to get murdered right in front of her. And then, like, oh, surprise, he's back in the final reel and he's one of the killers. So, like, Billy is, like, that dude from the 90s. Like, that is who Billy is. And I think that there's, like, a really interesting like difference in the kind of guy that Richie is. Like, Richie is like the new guy. Like, Richie is the new nice guy.
Here
in the year 2022, when this movie is coming out, like, he is a man who is, like, of this moment and who presents in a really different way from Billy. And who has, like, a lot of the same rage, but with a really different source. And so I thought that that was, like, really interesting to consider, like, the ways that their masculinity is the same or is different, and the way in which, like, their rage is the same or is different, and the way in which, like, their characters as boyfriends are written to be the same or different. Like, Richie is a far more supportive boyfriend than Billy Loomis, for sure. Like, you really feel like he wants to protect Sam. He wants to make sure that Sam and her sister are okay. And that's all a ruse, but, like, it's a very believable one.
Yeah, I feel like Billy feels very, like, Jordan Catalano, you know? Even the hair. And Richie is very, like Adam Scott in Parks and Rec. You know, like, he's, like, nerdy and unassuming and, like, harmless. And actually, he's not. Like, that's just another mask he's put on.
He reminded me of Landry from Friday Night Lights.
Oh, yeah. I could see that. Or Lucas.
Yeah.
Lucas, for sure. Yeah, he is the nice guy. And he is so written to be, just our idea of, like, a non-threatening man. And it's, that's very, very interesting. What did you think of Dewey dying?
Oh, wow. I feel like, you know, the movie kind of says, like, as its thesis statement, that, like, we needed for there to be stakes. And I would rather, if we're going to get rid of one of the original cast, it makes a lot of sense for it to be Dewey. I would rather lose Dewey than lose Gail or lose Sydney, 100% for sure. But I also feel like a thing that you don't see in, like, I think, like, Dewey's death is really done in an interesting way and in a way that you don't often see in horror movies. Dewey knows when he doesn't get in the elevator that he's gonna die. I mean, I think that you could read Dewey's death as, like, you know, part of it is, like, is he gonna go back and try to be the hero? But, like, Dewey has been stabbed so many times. Like, Dewey is carrying, like, the weight of all the previous murders. Like, when we see him in Scream, what was it, Scream 2 or Scream 4, like, he has a lot of injuries. Like, he can't feel half of his body. He has, like, a limp. He has, like, permanent debilitating injuries from what he has been through. He's probably, like, suffering from a lot of chronic pain. When we come upon him, like, the highlight of his day is watching his former wife on her, like, morning show and stuff. So he's, like, he doesn't have, like, a lot going for himself. And so it's almost like when you see Dewey decide not to get in the elevator, it's almost like in that moment, Dewey has made the calculation that, like, he's not a final girl anymore. Like, the fight that keeps you trying to survive, like, that keeps you running up the stairs, that keeps you, like, kicking Ghostface, like, he's like, he doesn't have it anymore. He's going to try to end this, but he's got to know that it's like 99-1 against him getting out of that place alive, I think. And I think that that's a really, like, it's a really interesting choice. It's like Spike going, it's like Spike staying at the bottom of the Hellmouth with the medallion.
Yeah, I love the way you put that, that he knows he's not the final girl. I think a thing that people often forget is that Dewey's sister was murdered by Ghostface in the first movie. Like, that's a thing too.
Yeah.
This might be a hot take. Of all of the Scream movies, this one is my favorite David Arquette performance. I think he is great. And I don't, like, I have not seen him in a lot outside of the Scream franchise. I don't know that he's somebody that I would call a great actor generally, but I think he is so, and maybe it's because, you know, my understanding is maybe David Arquette's fallen on a couple hard times himself, but like, he is so good in this movie. And I think the, like, the way he goes from like broken to reluctant to sort of hopeful to ultimately accepting of his fate, it's such a good arc. Like, it's such a satisfying arc for this character. And it's also like, you know, Dewey gets stabbed half to death in every movie, basically. Like you said, it sort of feels right that this would be the final one. And I actually love that Ghostface says to him, you know, this is, it's an honor. Because there is something sort of, there is this way in which the ghost face of this movie have a lot of respect for Dewey, Sidney, and Gale. They're going to kill them, you know, mm-hmm. but there, it's like it. And that, like, you had said something about sort of the way that this movie's relationship with fandom. And there is something in there about, like, these are celebrities that these killers are going to gleefully murder, but they're going to do it with respect. And that feels like quite a metaphor for fandom and for celebrity culture at large.
Yeah, I agree. I think that one of the things that's really interesting about the run of the Scream movies is the way that, like, when the first Scream came out, the world was really different from the world that Scream in 2022 takes place in. Like, for example, Drew Barrymore answered the landline, which she had, which was like the primary phone. And this movie has to, like, look at, like, why does this person have a landline? Why are they picking up the landline? Like, they're trying to electronically lock all of their doors because that's what you do now. Like, technology has changed and the world has changed. And, like, the motives of Ghostface have changed and are about, like, popularity and are about, like, the legend of these murders. And in that way, like, the legend of Dewey and Gale and Sidney and how originally they were survivors. And then when all of the Stab movies came out, they became, like, celebrity survivors almost. Renowned for their ability to, like, live till the end of the movie. And so I feel like taking that away from Dewey is, it's a really powerful choice. And I'm really glad that he got to go out that way. I think it was David Arquette's best performance. I think that he's so comedic in the original Scream movie. And that he, like, his constant, like, his journey in the original movies is, like, he's kind of like the cowardly lion. Like, he's searching for this bravery and this bravado that he doesn't really feel. Like, he's a cop, he has a gun, he's, like, incredibly scared most of the time. Yeah. And I feel like by the time you get to this movie, like, he's world weary, he's, like, a veteran of these battles. And, like, the number one thing that he has said to Gale and Sidney is, like, don't come back. Whatever you do, don't come here. But, of course, it's his death that's going to be the thing that brings Sidney Prescott to town.
Yeah. And, yes, I loved, like, in the previous Scream movies, there's been this real thing about, like, Sidney is broken. Sidney's in witness protection. She's a shell of herself. She's destroyed. And I really like that, like, when we see Sidney at the beginning of this movie, like, she seems really good. She's happy. She's married and she has kids and she's out for a run and she looks great. And there's this real sense of like, Sydney figured it out. Sydney got out and she figured out how to make this life for herself. And Dewey couldn't quite get out. Like, Dewey couldn't quite escape the demons. And then, like, Gail is such an interesting one because, like, a twist that I've always loved with Gail is that she's the one who profited from the murders, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, what a weird element that is. Like, this sort of the seediness of Gail is so fascinating. And then also you throw in the behind the scenes of, like, this is an actually divorced couple, like, playing out a divorce on screen. Like, what a weird, interesting thing that is. But I love the way that, like, I love the arc of Gail and Sydney's relationship and how there was so much animosity between them. And they're still not necessarily best buds all the time, but they now know that they have each other's backs.
Yeah, there's so much mutual respect and admiration there. Even though, like, Gail has created this monster to some extent. Like, she is definitely, like, the reporter who is, like, written these books that became these movies that, but on the other hand, she's also survived everything as well.
Well, and I agree. And I think that, like, that kind of goes to your point a bit about, like, the world that we're in now versus the world we were in then, because I think that, like, now, you know, we live in this time where there's so much true crime media, but there's also a lot more conversation about, like, what is the negative impact of true crime media, of turning true crime into entertainment, of, like, giving a serial killer or, you know, a moniker and sort of, you know, is it actually better to never say the name of the killer and only say the name of the victims? Like, that's an interesting element as well. And I feel like Gail is such an interesting character to sort of play out some of those conflicts with.
Yeah. Oh, I totally, totally agree. And I just like the way that, like, now when Sydney comes back to town and when she's talking to Gail and they're in the hospital and Dewey is dead, like, they watch Sam and her sister go off in the car with someone who's going to turn out to be one of the killers. But, like, they watch them drive away and Sydney has a moment of saying, like, I don't know, you know, she seems pretty tough. And, like, there's this acknowledgement that, like, she and Gail have seen versions of this movie so many times.
Yes.
And so they, like, they're, like, almost, like, you know, and with everybody being, like, the next generation, like, this is, like, the nieces the niece and nephew of Randy. This is, like, the daughter of Billy Loomis. Like, you almost get a sense of, like, Sydney and Gail as, like, the moms that are, like, watching their daughters, like, drive off to college or something, like, driving off to this adventure that's new to them, but that they know is going to have, like, a lot of bumps in the road. And, of course, like, you know, Sydney being Sydney, they're like, oh, yeah, well, I mean, of course, I'm tracking her car.
Right, right. Oh, I love that.
Way to go. Like,
I love that. Well, and that there's also this sense of, like, they're kind of in the audience with us. You know, they're watching this movie play out along with us. And it's sort of like, because we've all seen all of the Scream movies and we've all been following Sydney's journey from the first one, it's like, it's sort of like there's this way in which Sydney is even more the audience proxy now, because it's like, you know, if we were characters in the movie, we would be saying to Sam, oh, there's no way you're going to outrun Ghostface, because, like, we know the rules. And that reminds me a little bit of, like, the experience of watching PLL, and every time the liars are like, oh, we've caught A and this is all finally over and everything will go back to normal. And we know, like, girls, it's like the third episode of a 10 episode half season. Obviously, you have not caught A, you know? Yeah, it's very, very interesting that way. Should we talk a little bit just about Neve Campbell and, like,
oh my gosh,
Neve Campbell.
So Neve Campbell, when she was originally in the Scream movies, she'd been on Party of Five, where, of course, Julia Salinger does have an arc about kissing. Okay, it was always there, her professor, I believe. but, you know, so she has this, like, you know, girl-on-girl kiss that's, like, a plot point in Party of Five. She was in Drowning Mona, where she played a lesbian character. She was in Wild Things, where she kisses a girl. She was in The Craft, which is like Scream, like an extremely queer movie without being like overtly LGBT. So like Nev Campbell coming from those things and then like being the final girl in Scream, just like be still my heart. I have watched her in so many things, in so many projects that I never would have like watched if she hadn't been in them. But the Scream franchise, like consistently her work in it has just brought me great, great joy. And when you talked about like how well she seems to be doing in this movie, one of my favorite endings to the Scream movies, and I want to say it's the ending to Scream 3, but it's when Sydney, and she's like living in this like kind of remote cabin, and she mm-hmm. leaves to go for a walk and she doesn't lock the door. And I just like, I love that image of Sydney just having like that freedom in her life where she's not looking over her shoulder anymore.
Yeah, right, which is like the thing we always talk about wanting for The Liars.
Yeah,
it's so funny because I feel like there's so many parallels with like Sydney coming back to Westboro and Woodsboro is the Westboro Baptist Church. That's not what this is about. Woodsboro, thank you. And The Liars coming back to Rosewood, and just this idea of like the scene when Spencer sees the girls getting the text and she has that moment of tensing up and then she relaxes. Nev Campbell is so good. She never misses. She's just like, she is the ultimate final girl. Like she is so, and I think she's done a thing that rarely gets to happen, which is that she's aged into the final woman.
Yes. And
the final woman is like not a character that usually gets to exist in horror films. And yet she does. She's like creating her own mold.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Gale as well.
Yes.
They get to be as old as they are and still having survived all this. Also, like, just that they have survived, like, watching so many people that they know and care about getting murdered again and again and again. And that they're not letting it, they're not, like, the liars are so traumatized that they're often, like, almost re-traumatizing themselves. They're making the same mistakes. Whereas, like, Sydney and Gale are able to, like, look at Amber like weeping outside the house and be like, what do you think? Trap? Yes, trap. And then of course it's a trap. And Amber like shoots Gale. And it's like, of course she's gonna shoot at Gale, because you have to like you're not gonna shoot at Sydney. Sydney is the final girl.
Exactly. So. And also like Gale is the one who like interacts with guns.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I loved that moment when they were like, what do you think, trap? Because I've referenced this before. Like, one of my favorite moments in the original Scream is the moment also like in that same part of Stu's house, you know, where Randy and Stu are both saying like, he's the killer. And Matthew Lillard is so good in that movie. And they're just both like hamming it up. And Sydney just closes the door and says, fuck you both. Like that. That's a great moment in cinema in general. And this felt like kind of a version of a callback to that I just really loved.
Yeah. And I also think it's really interesting in this movie. Like we have seen in a lot of other Scream movies, like it's almost like a staple of the movie where someone is like, let me in, oh my god, I'm gonna get murdered out here, and the people who are like in the room are like, they can't like make the decision to let that person in because they think like, but what if that person is the killer, and then that person winds up getting brutally murdered. And in this movie we have people who are acting like, well, Tara might be in on it. Like Tara might be the other ghost face. And so Sam comes upon Tara apparently like tied up in the closet, and she has this moment of hesitation, and it's like, oh, you know, we feel like this is the thing we've seen before. Like you can't trust anybody, not even your own sister. What are you gonna do? But in this movie, Sam makes a different choice and it winds up saving everybody's life. She's like, fuck that shit. Like, fuck the noise that you men are giving to me about this. I am going to trust my sister. And that is going to be like, that's eventually what like gets everybody out of it at the end.
I love so much that you have like these sort of sibling relationships in all these different ways. Like you have the Meeks twins, who are both great. And I'm so glad that they both survive. And you have, Sam and Tara. And then like, I mean, obviously, of course I ship Gail and Sydney, but there's also a real sisterhood thing with Gail and Sydney too. And I really enjoy the sort of the many examples of like, you know, siblinghood.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is so true. Also, man, Mason Gooding, I was like, I'm going to have to look up this actor's name because he keeps turning up in stuff. He was in Booksmart.
Yep.
And he was, of course, he's in Love, Victor. And he's in this movie. He's the male Meeks twin. And I was like, man, he is in like all of these movies playing this like type of role. This like, you know,
yes,
somewhat arrogant jock, but like secretly with a heart of gold or whatever, who's like, you know, who's kind of like the eye candy a little bit.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I feel like he is in the 90s, that was Breckin Meyer, who like always played those parts. He was in The Craft. He was in,
yeah.
He was in that movie with Meg Ryan. He was in Clueless. So I feel like
he's in Josie and the Pussycats.
Yeah. So yeah, I feel like Mason Gooding is like the new Breckin Meyer for sure.
Oh, I totally agree. I think he's great. Also, again, I know that you don't watch Yellow Jackets, haven't watched Yellow Jackets yet. Jasmine Savoy Brown is great in Yellow Jackets, is queer in Yellow Jackets, and is queer in real life, and is queer in this movie.
Yes, so happy that she is queer in this movie and is queer in real life. I cheered when I looked that up and saw that was the case.
Yeah, and she's fabulous in Yellow Jackets. So yeah, loved her. So glad she got to survive. Also just, I really liked the idea of like the film nerd of 2022 is like a queer black woman, and the, you know, as opposed to like the white straight guy of Randy Meeks, like that. I thought that was really fun.
Yeah, I definitely agree there. And I loved that we've like come to the point now where the queerness can be really overt and where like she's as much of a Lothario as her brother is. Like,
yes.
She's like, they're like, what's going to happen now? And she's like, well, I'm maybe going to hook up with like this girl who's sitting on the other end of the couch. And then like the other people leave the room and she kind of like just motions to that girl. And
yes.
Like, it's on.
I loved that.
Yeah. I felt like that was like, and also that was like the kind of queerness that we've talked about not seeing on PLL in the later,
yes,
the later seasons. So I was really happy to encounter it here, even momentarily in one of the Scream films.
I totally agree. I also really liked, first of all, I think the best death of the movie was Wes's death. That was brutal.
Oh man. So I am not like a horror movie person, but I have a habit when I'm watching these movies of always like trying to predict what the death is going to be. And I thought that his death was going to be, they were going to use his taser on him when he was in the shower, because there was such a long shower scene. And I was like, is it Chekhov's taser? Is it? But then, oh man. Yeah. That series of murders was just like, whoo.
And his mom, like, I thought that was a great, like, you know, not as high stakes as like Dewey's death, but like a good, like, middle of the movie. Like, we have some attachment to these characters. I liked how they played with the, like, they totally played with our expectations because we're like, oh, of course he's going to get stabbed in the shower. Then he doesn't get stabbed in the shower. And like, it's a long sequence of him just like walking around the house, setting the table for dinner. And I always think it's like sort of even creepier when Ghostface kills people in daylight, because you don't expect it. It's like the sun is out. You think you're safe. You're in a suburban neighborhood. And the fact that he kills both of them just right there, her right there, you know, on her front porch, basically, and him on the other side of the door. I loved that. I thought that was a really, really like shocking, but effective kill.
Yeah. And the idea like that had like a lot of like Buffy and the Master to it. Like if you hadn't come, I couldn't go. Like,
yeah,
I lured you back here. And now after I kill you, then it's going to open the door for me to kill your son. Like, oh man.
Yes. Oh, I thought that was really, really good. And, yeah, it had all these fun, interesting little callbacks and moments, but I felt like it really hit the right amount of self-referential.
Yeah. Yeah. I certainly agree with that. I thought it was terrific. I really enjoyed it as an installment in the Scream franchise.
I did too. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about with it?
Oh yeah. We need to talk about the motive, which is, it's very PLL. The motive is that the killers are fans. They're involved in a really toxic fandom dynamic where they feel like the stab movies have jumped the shark so significantly that they want to like create a series of murders that will be used for the next movie that they feel is going to be more satisfying in terms of a narrative. Yeah. Their plan is that they're going to pin the murders on Sam, the daughter of Billy Loomis, and that is going to be like the satisfying conclusion. And I think that like speaks a lot to PLL and to discussions of toxic fandom, like the Snyder Cut and all of the things that go on with that. Because at one point, like Richie is saying, like, how can it be toxic when it's all about loving a thing, when it's loving a thing mm-hmm. so much? And I feel like that's something that PLL is always asking us, like, well, how could it be toxic when it's the OTP? And it's like, I love that the Scream franchise is recognizing that, like, whatever it's born out of, whether it's love or whether it's hate, it can be toxic. This is toxic. Like, you're murdering dozens of people. It's toxic.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's like, I love that. And I also feel like it's kind of a commentary on, you know, people on Twitter sending death threats to writers of shows for not, you know, or movies or Drag Race contestants or whatever mm-hmm. for like not behaving the way that they want it to. Like, it is this sort of message of like, everybody calm down. Like,
yeah.
Like, everybody take a breath here. And, you know, this sort of like, I feel like it's also in some ways a commentary on like the sexism that comes out and the misogyny that comes out in like, you know, or, and the racism that comes out in things like the Star Wars franchise, for example,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's sort of like this, like, so it is this sort of almost absurdist version of, you know, those Reddit forums in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was great. And it is this interesting too, like the way that it sort of becomes this like snake eating its own tail of like, we're the inspiration and then somebody will write the story and then they'll write the story and hopefully they'll write the story and maybe even make it even better. And, you know, it's like this, and this idea of like, I will die for this. I will die for my art. I mean, there's also an interesting read in there. And I think a discussion that has been very much in the forefront of our culture right now is like separating the art from the artist. Right.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, the original Scream movies were, Miramax, the Weinstein company.
Yeah.
And so it is very interesting to think about like this sort of chicken egg thing that these Scream movies are, especially later Scream movies, are sort of exploring.
Yeah, I certainly think that is true. And also like the way that you scratch the surface of that toxic fandom and the misogyny just pours right out of it. Like,
yeah,
he's been involved with Sam this whole time. He seemed like a supportive boyfriend. And then you get to the climax and he's like, I mean, it wasn't hard to find you. in wherever they are, like Modesto or wherever she had been. Like, it wasn't hard to find you. And it wasn't that hard to get you to sleep with me either. Like, and it's just like, oh, like the contempt that's just like pouring out of him in that moment is so like, it's so extreme. It does feel like very Lucas.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that is so much at the heart of the Billy and Stu murder, the initial murder and the vitriol towards Sydney's mother.
Yeah, yeah.
Your like mother was no Sharon Stone.
Yeah, that's like it's all connected. Sydney's mom, Sam's mom, Sam herself. The way that the way that the movie is interacting with her. So I like that, and I also like just the strength of like the women banding together in the end. That you have Gail, you have Sydney, you have Tara, you have Sam, who are all surviving. This particular installment.
Well, and also, okay, so it's been a little while since I've seen it. You've seen it more recently, so tell me if this is right. Amber and Richie, are they a couple?
I don't think so. I think they just met on like a fan forum.
Okay, because I felt like there was an implication that they had slept together or wanted to sleep together or something like that, which, I mean, anyways, place it is interesting in terms of him being an older man and her being a high school girl. Where have we seen that dynamic before?
Yeah, if there was, I may have missed it. The explanation of how they know each other is extremely brief. Like, it's
yes,
like,
yes.
Blink and you miss it. I'll go back and I'll check that because that would be kind of interesting. But no, I didn't get like a romantic vibe between the two of them.
Okay. Well, either way, yeah, this dynamic of this younger woman and this older guy is really fascinating. Especially since Mikey Madison is her name, that actress, not Mikey Day. That's a SNL cast member. She was also, I believe, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as a Manson follower. So she has a pattern of playing murderous women involved with older men.
Okay, so here's a question. Did you read Amber as queer in this movie?
In terms of her sort of obsession with Tara?
Well, I felt like there was, like, because there's a moment when like, I think it's Wes is kind of being accused, like, oh, you had a crush on Tara and everyone knew about it. And if you can't have her, no one could. Like, that's often a
yes.
motive that they put, like, that's Stu's motive for killing Drew Barrymore in the first original movie. So, like, Stu is being accused, but, like, you're seeing Amber as those words are said. And so it kind of is
important
that, like, maybe Amber is the one who feels that way. And then later there's kind of a close face watch when she is she's downstairs with the queer Meeks twin. And they're like kind of like doing a banter about like which of them could be the killer and who you should go downstairs with or shouldn't go downstairs with and stuff like that. So there's kind of a moment between those two. So I was just wondering, like, do you read Amber as a queer character in the context of the movie?
I can totally see that. And actually, that scene reminded me so much of the scene from Scream 1 where Stu and Billy are antagonizing Randy in the video store. And there's a lot of close face watch. Stu's like arms are around Randy and they're like holding him tight and they're like threatening him, but they're also kind of flirting with him and they're also kind of flirting with each other. And that scene between Amber and queer Meeks twin, Jasmine Savoy Brown, reminded me of that moment as well.
Yeah,
it's sort of the hate flirt vibes.
Yes.
Yeah. I could definitely see a reading that Amber is queer. For sure.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of Scream and PLL is the use of guns. Like, what do guns represent in the slasher genre when all of a sudden they're like, because we've talked about like in PLL, all of a sudden Shauna is wielding this gun and shooting at people. And here at the end of this movie, we have like Dewey goes back with a gun. Sidney Prescott is like, I'm Sidney Prescott. Of course I own a gun. And then like the tussle for guns at the end becomes like a pivotal part of this film.
Well, it is interesting how consistently in the Scream movies, it'll be like the gun doesn't become important until the third act, you know, yeah. Because I think knives are inherently scarier and more intimate weapons,
yes.
And, you know, more dramatic weapons. Sure. Yeah, I guess I don't know what exactly to make of it. I mean, it is really different seeing a teenager wielding a gun in 2022 than seeing a teenager wielding a gun in the 90s, you know? Yeah, like that just holds a different weight for sure. And I guess I don't really know what to make of it. I think there's a way in which it implies like the game is over, right? It's like knives are the sort of the fun, sexy weapon. And it's like, okay, now it's time for the end game. It's time for it to bring out the guns. Guns are not fun and sexy in the Scream world. Guns are like finality in a sense. But I don't know. What do you make of them?
Does Ghostface ever shoot anyone? I don't feel like I feel like Ghostface only ever stabs people or like murders them brutally, like with a garage door.
You mean like Ghostface when they're just being Ghostface?
Yeah, in the Ghostface mask. I don't know that we ever see Ghostface in a Ghostface mask shoot somebody.
I don't know that we do either. Right, because like in Scream 2, I feel like Timothy Oliphant, he like takes off the thing and then he shoots Jerry O'Connell, I think.
I think that, yeah, I would have to watch that again. But yeah, it's like, I feel like if you were going to have Ghostface in the Ghostface mask shoot people, then the whole franchise would be so different. It would be like Ghostface could like be a sniper from like 100,000 yards away. Like, that's not what this is about. Like, the stabbing is very personal. And then I feel like when you get to the end and there's always this like, who's got the gun? Who's going to shoot who? Like, what's going to happen? I feel like in those moments, it's about the explosion of rage. It's about like,
yeah,
you know, and I think that is really interesting. And we definitely see that. We definitely see that in this movie when Amber is revealed as the killer. She like just comes in packing and she shoots Dale Meeks' twin's girlfriend.
Yes. Yeah, that's really true. Well, the other interesting thing about knives, and I know this from watching many episodes of Criminal Minds, is that knives are often a metaphor for penises and often a sign of impotence and rage. Mm. And so that, you know, is potentially an interesting aspect of all of this as well.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, but I really liked this movie. I liked the motives, I liked the setup, I liked the characters. I'm here. If there is a Scream 6, I'm definitely watching. And I hope that Neve Campbell is around through like Scream 10 and beyond. That is my hope.
Here's a question for you. And I'm very much putting you on the spot, but I'll answer it too. Which actor from the PLL verse would you most like to see in a theoretical Scream 6? And like, what would their archetypal role be?
Oh man. That is such a tough question, especially since Lucy has already been in one of the movies in a small way. Okay. So which of the PLL cast members? I am going to say I would pick Ashley Benson.
Okay.
And I would have her bring some more queerness into the PLL verse. I wouldn't mind if the next one takes place like when they're in college. I wouldn't mind having her be like the sugar mama of the queer Meeks twin.
Oh, I like that a lot. That would be really fun. Like maybe she's like still like into fashion or something. Like
she's, sugar mama. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. For some reason I feel like handcuffs would be involved. Like they'd start as sexy handcuffs and then it would become like a ghost face thing.
I would love to see Ashley Benson, I think. just because I would like to see, like, and this is a franchise that is now having, like, queer characters played by queer actors. So in that sense, Ashley Benson. I do think that, like, I do think that Shay would be decent, but I think that, like, Ashley Benson would, like, really fit what the franchise does really well.
I like that. I like that a lot. I'm going to say that I would like Janelle as a character who is, like, a teacher, like, either, like, maybe it's the college setting or maybe it's still in high school. But either way, she appears to just be the teacher, but we find out that she's actually, like, a private investigator.
Oh, nice.
Who's, like, trying to, you know, maybe she's been hired by one of the family members to try to figure out something, or maybe she's been, like, you know, but she somehow ends up, like, on the case.
I like it. I like it a lot.
And she's very mysterious. And, like, maybe there's, like, the implication that, like, she and Gail have, like, slept together at some point.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, ideally, I would love to have the franchise end with, like, Sydney and her female lover riding off into the sunset together. If it's Gail, if it's not, that would be terrific. But I also feel like there's a lot of potential. We do have the Queer Meeks twin running around. And we don't really know, like, we don't know about Tara Carpenter's sexuality. We don't know if there was something going on with her and Amber or not. And we certainly, it certainly doesn't seem like there's any indication that Sam would be exclusively heterosexual. So true. I think we have a lot of potential for either of them to be queer in future installments.
Do you ship Sydney and Gail?
I haven't really in the past, but I could get on board with it for sure.
Yeah, I feel like there's a I'm good with either version of that for sure.
Well, especially like I wouldn't have shipped them like in the early movies just because like Gail was like older and involved with Dewey and everything, but I feel like at this point, like their age difference is no longer material. Like they've already been through so much that if they felt like celebrating their continued survival together, then who am I to say no to that?
Who are you? Exactly. It would be very fun. It would be very, very fun. Also, like, I feel like somebody from the PLL verse could be a good, you know, there's often the role of, like, Gail's camera person.
Yes.
And I feel like that could be a fun role for, really anybody from PLL.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Okay, if you were going to cast somebody from PLL as the killer in a future
Ooh.
Scream movie. I have two picks for this.
Okay.
My first pick is going to be the guy who played Noel.
Oh, yeah, Brant Doherty. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He'd be he has, great. Yeah, he has that.
He has essence. The thing. Yes.
Yeah, he's got it. He could be a good ghost face. And then my other one would be Ren. So charming.
Oh, yeah.
So charming that you would not suspect him.
Keegan Allen. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I'll pick him as a murder victim. Like, I'll pick him as, like, the girl who gets murdered in the first 5 minutes, like, her boyfriend.
I'm going to say Troyan. I think Troyan would do a really interesting, like, you know, maybe it's like a thing of like she seems like she's like the mousy librarian kind of character. And then it's like, no, she's actually the killer. I'm also going to submit one more role here. I know that Lucy's already been in it, but like we can ignore that. I want to see a thing where Lucy is like the plucky young reporter who is sort of trying to take over Gail's beat. And then a sort of antagonistic thing.
That reminds me of one of my favorite scenes where it's Sarah Michelle Gellar, right, who's playing Gail Weathers in the Stab movie, and so she decides that she's just going to keep hanging.
Parker Posey.
Is it Parker Posey? Okay.
Yeah, Sarah Michelle Gellar gets killed in Scream 2.
Okay, I was like, who? Okay, Parker Posey, And they decide that they are going to just hang around Gale because if the murderer wants to murder them, they'll just choose to murder, like, the actual Gale Weathers. And I really enjoy that scene quite a lot.
You know, Scream 3 is so dumb, but it's so hard to not enjoy a Parker Posey performance, you know? Yes.
I agree that movie is really uneven, but there are things about it that I really love. I love when they're on the set of the Prescott house and Sydney runs up the stairs and through the door, and then she's just hanging in space.
Yes. Because
the door doesn't actually go anywhere. And I think that that's like such an interesting, like, that's kind of a thesis statement about the way that the Stab movies work. Like,
yes,
that, you know, it's just like it until it's not, until you're just hanging in space.
Totally agree. I totally agree. Well, do we have any more we want to say about Scream?
We had quite a lot to say, but no,
we did.
I think we're good. I can't wait until there's another one that we can talk about and appreciate Neve Campbell in even more.
I totally agree. Also, just getting better with age, Neve Campbell. Like, she looks great.
I love your like nominating of her to be like the final woman instead of the final girl. Like, it makes me feel like if we ever got like a Buffy movie where Buffy has lived to be like the age that Sarah Michelle Gellar is, like that would be fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. A team up, a Buffy Sydney team up. It would be glorious.
I would ship that. For sure.
I don't even think they interact in Scream 2, which is criminal. But anyway, that could be a whole other discussion. If you have thoughts on the Scream franchise, who, you know, which PLL cast you'd sub in there, or which PLL characters you'd like to see in the Screamverse, you can, of course, send us an email at everybodyapodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out our Instagram at everybodyapodcast. You can also check out our Spotify, everybodyagay, and you can send in a rating and review on iTunes. We would appreciate it. This was such a fun discussion. I liked our little reboot-a-thon.
I did too.
So till next time.
Take care. Okay. Breaking news on the Scream front. Since we recorded originally, I went back and I looked it up, and Vina was completely correct. Amber is his girlfriend, which, ew! Wanted to, like, come back and have an addendum so we could both say, ew!
Ew! Ew! Just let it be known, I did not, like, ask for this public I told you so, but yeah, it's super gross. It's super, super gross. And it just makes that whole dynamic even creepier. And, you know, I think is an interesting kind of element of like men preying on younger women or younger girls on the internet.
Yeah, I completely agree. No, I know. And you would be much more gracious to ever be like, hi, I told you so. But I'm glad that you caught that. And because I had not, like, it was really not something that like the story dwelled on in any way, probably because it's disgusting. But yes, you were 100% correct. And I am glad that you called that out and called it to my notice.
It is kind of like if, you know, Presria, turned into serial killers.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
Yes.
Arya is a little too non-confrontational to be a serial killer in my opinion, but it's true that Presria can often convince her of anything.
Yeah. Oh, I think he could get her to kill. I think she'd kill for him, for sure. Pigtunia would get her to kill for him. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
Well, is that all we have to add to this episode?
Yes. Just a general ew.
A general ew. That's what we will leave you with, dear listeners. General ew for this gross relationship.